I believe it was Mark Twain who once said that the parts of the Bible that disturbed him most were not the parts he couldn't understand, but the parts that he could. Some of the teachings of Jesus are so radical that most people can't imagine any way to put them into practice. And near the top of the list when people are discussing such things usually comes part of today's gospel reading, the bit about cutting off parts of your body if they lead you into sin. In fact, I reckon that that part is far from the most radical teaching in this section of Mark's gospel or even in this passage. The thing that is most radical is perhaps so radical that we can't even begin to believe it or even imagine it, and so we overlook it entirely. We just don't notice it. And actually, the gospel writer seems to predict that because he's telling us that the first disciples were similarly oblivious to it. No matter how many times Jesus told them, they just kept right on making the same mistake over and over and over. And part of the disaster of our continued incomprehension is that as a result, we have read the gruesome bit about self-mutilation being better than ending up burning in hellfire as meaning almost the polar opposite to what Jesus was probably saying. Now, let me show you how Mark portrays this in his gospel account, because we actually have to look at what comes before and after tonight's extract to see what's going on. Because we're working through a section over several weeks in which, right at the midpoint of his story, Mark depicts the disciples repeatedly showing just how much they don't get it. The section tellingly begins and ends with stories of Jesus opening the eyes of blind people. And as if that wasn't an obvious enough metaphor for what's going on in the stories in between, in the first one, Jesus is having trouble opening the eyes of the blind man. On his first attempt, the man can only see people that look like trees walking around, and Jesus has to have another go before the man can see clearly. It's hard work getting people to see clearly, as the stories in between show. So here's how it progresses. First, after the healing, this first healing of the blind man, as we heard 2 weeks ago, Simon Peter identifies Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah, and Jesus commended him for that, but within minutes, he's telling him off for completely misunderstanding what being the Messiah meant and trying to talk Jesus into a more powerful and impressive approach to being the Messiah. Next, three of the disciples witness Jesus transfigured on the mountain, and then when they come down, they encounter the rest of their group trying unsuccessfully to cast a demon out of a demonized boy. Then last week, we heard how the disciples were completely missing the point when they started arguing with one another over who was the greatest. And in response, Jesus took a small child in his arms and said that the measure of greatness was the ability to welcome those who were small and seemingly unimportant as though they were Jesus himself. Now tonight we hear that the very next thing that happens is that one of the disciples, John, reports that they came across a bloke who was casting out demons in Jesus' name. But don't worry, says John, we stopped him because he wasn't one of us. And Jesus has to tell him off again. And you notice the irony that Mark develops in the story here. The disciples have just tried to cast out a demon in Jesus' name, and they couldn't do it. Now they come across a bloke who's managing to do it, actually successfully healing demonized people, and they think they should stop him because he's not one of them. Jesus' response to this includes these difficult words about amputations being better than hellfire. But then if we jump ahead and look another dozen or so verses ahead, we find, believe it or not, that the disciples are trying to stop people from bringing their children to Jesus, as though Jesus hadn't just told them that welcoming children was the sign of greatness in his community. And then we've got the story of the rich young ruler choosing not to follow Jesus and the disciples expressing bewilderment when Jesus says that the rich will find it hard to get in. And then James and John ask Jesus if they can sit on his right and left in glory. So once again, we've got the disciples jockeying for position to see who can be the greatest. They just don't get it. And then we have the second story of the healing of a blind man. Jesus is having trouble opening the eyes of these guys. And Mark hints that, unlike the disciples, the blind man does get it. So Mark is trying hard to warn us just how hard it is, even as followers of Jesus, to get our heads around the importance of what Jesus is saying here. And he emphasizes it with this way that he structures the story, with this series of frames. We've got two stories of opening the eyes of the blind, enclosing two stories of the disciples trying to establish themselves as the greatest, enclosing two stories of welcoming children as the model of the kingdom life, and then the central story in the middle of all this set of frames is tonight's extract. So there's no question that Mark not only wants us to really tune into this story, but that he wants us to read it in the context of all these framing stories. So let's tune into it now. Most of the attention usually falls on the meaning of verse 42. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believes in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone was hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. That verse leads into the stuff about cutting off body parts being preferable to burning in hellfire. So causing a little one to stumble is what we're being so strongly warned against. Better a millstone tied around your neck or your body chopped into bits than for you to put a stumbling block in front of a little one. It's probably no surprise to you that I have had this verse pointed at me many times, usually because of my allegedly lax and heretical attitudes to homosexuality and premarital cohabitation. Supposedly, by allowing people to think that their sins are okay, I'm causing them to stumble, and therefore I'm destined to burn in hellfire. But such an interpretation, although it's understandable, ignores all the context and the framing that Mark builds around it. There's another sort of framing here too. It's Mark's other signature technique called sandwiching, where he interrupts one story by inserting another one into it. And this is important here too, because this story about John trying to stop an unauthorized exorcist from healing demonized people in Jesus' name, for not being one of their group, it's sandwiched into Jesus' comments about little children. Listen to how naturally it flows if you take it out. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believes in me, it would be better for you that a millstone hung around your neck and you're cast into the sea. So if you take that bit out, there's just this continuation of talking about the little ones. It makes perfect sense like that, and it makes it clearer that the ones that we better not cause to stumble are firstly the children who Jesus is welcoming. But when Mark inserts the story into the middle, the story of the unauthorized exorcist, we announce the two stories are supposed to be interpreted in relation to one another. They shed light on each other. So what are they saying to each other here? The story of the stopping the unauthorized exorcist being framed by the comments about welcoming children and then by the incidents of the disciples jockeying for recognition as the greatest, the story begins to be clearly seen as being about a failure to welcome the outsider in the way that Jesus would wish the outsider to be welcomed. And that failure is seen as a consequence of the desire to protect and promote our own position and status as the most privileged of the insiders. And in light of that story, the image of putting a stumbling block before the little ones begins to be seen not so much as causing them to sin, but putting an obstacle in their path when they seek to approach Jesus and gain the sort of access to Jesus that we insiders have. So why do I say that's so radical? Let me illustrate. On Friday, I went to the Royal Melbourne Show. I go most years, not as often as Lindsay, who lives just across the road from the show and goes every day, every year, but I usually go for at least one day. But this year was different. For the first time, I was an exhibitor or an entrant. I had one of my dogs entered in the Action Dogs Obedience Competition. And the whole experience of being at the show felt rather different. I got to enter by a special gate. I had a special badge to wear. I got to walk around in areas that I have not previously been allowed to go in. I was treated differently by many people. I was now treated as one of us instead of one of them. If I walked through a public area with my dog, members of the public stopped and looked at us admiringly. Our actual performance in the ring was a lot less than admirable, but for most of the day, that didn't matter. I was one of the privileged ones, an insider. I've had a little bit of the same feeling at this time some years when my team made the grand final, and as a member, one of the real supporters, I got a ticket to go. It's a very seductive feeling. Everyone loves to feel accepted and special. Everyone loves to feel like an insider of a special and worthwhile group. But one of the almost universal human reactions to that feeling is to try and protect it by ensuring that it remains sufficiently exclusive. After all, if everyone is a privileged insider, there's no longer anything special about it, is there? Like, if everyone at the show has a special badge, I'm just another one of the ordinary crowd again. So we want to define and defend these boundaries. You're only allowed in if you measure up to these expectations and are approved by us. So the disciples want to stop people from bringing children to Jesus because access to Jesus is their special privilege and not something that mere children can share. And they want to stop the unauthorized exorcist healing people in Jesus' name because he's not one of us. And you have to be one of us to be allowed to do anything in Jesus' name, even if we're not much good at doing it ourselves in this particular case. And soon, even just being accepted as in by Jesus is not enough for them, and they have to start fighting over who is the most in, who is the closest to Jesus, who, the inner sanctum, the inner of the inner. And on we go, and on we have gone down through the centuries, defining our boundaries, protecting our privileged insider status. Nearly every church has lists of criteria by which certain people are excluded, if not from church membership, then certainly from holding positions of leadership. Every church has people who want to police the membership role and work out who shouldn't be on it anymore. This privilege is ours. We can't bear to cheapen it by allowing people who don't deserve to share it. And we see the same impulses at play in nearly every issue that causes any controversy. Endeavours to keep homosexual people out of the church have been a really obvious example, but you can hear it in the debates just about same-sex marriage outside the church as well. Many argue that you can't change the definition of marriage to include those people. Let them come up with a different word, their own label. Don't let them be seen as the same as us. So we have to defend marriage to keep them out of our privileged status. This is so universal that it is almost impossible for us to imagine the world without it. We certainly can't imagine the church without it. It seems to be something essential almost to the very nature of religion. Some people are part of this religion and some people aren't, and it's all pretty clear. It's a clear fundamental matter of identity. And if you were to take it away, the whole concept of becoming a committed member of a particular religion seems to fall apart. We can't imagine it. That's certainly what the disciples of Jesus thought. certainly what pretty much every one of us thinks most of the time. It is completely normal. But it's also something that Jesus says is hellishly wrong. It is precisely what Jesus calls putting a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me. Putting obstacles in front of those who want to draw close to Jesus. We see ourselves as courageously maintaining the standards of holiness and commitment. But Jesus sees us as narrowing our eyes and looking for excuses to shut people out, so that we can keep the privileged status of insiders for ourselves. And Jesus takes this so seriously that he resorts to the sort of wildly apocalyptic language that he usually rejects and tones down to describe his horror at such boundary policing being done in his name. You'd be better off with a millstone tied round your neck and thrown into the sea. You'd be better off with your hands and feet cut off and your eyes pulled out, he says. Suddenly, the only image of hellfire that Jesus uses is not for sinners outside the church, the way we've usually thought. It's for those inside the church who try to keep other people out by putting obstacles in their path. In one of the most extreme things that Jesus ever says, he basically says, "Open the doors to all comers or burn." Actually, before I finish, I need to admit that I may have overdone a bit the dismissing of the idea that this stumbling block has anything to do with causing others to sin, because that implication is actually still there as well. But it is most clearly about the children, and it's still in the same context, and so it's still on this same subject. And so it seems that the sort of causing of little ones to sin that Jesus is talking about is probably best understood as a fairly fierce reminder that our exclusionary policing of our insider and outsider boundaries moulds the behaviour of our children. If they observe us constantly treating outsiders with suspicion and hostility, they are likely to grow up doing the same thing themselves. That's why hardly any of us can begin to imagine the world without these categories and boundaries, because we've inherited that worldview. We've grown up with it, and we're in the process of passing it on again. But we've got it hellishly wrong, says Jesus. And when you stop to think about it, it may just be a statement of the bleeding obvious that we'd be better off drowning in the sea with millstones tied around our necks than drowning in the sea of hatreds and suspicions and hostilities and war that we have created for ourselves with our excluding, our divisiveness, our religious competitiveness. When we come to this table in a few minutes, it is fundamentally important that we remember that this is not our table. It is the Lord's table. It is the table of the one who rebukes our every impulse to fence it, to decide on his behalf who can and can't come to it, who is and isn't saved, or worthy, or acceptable, or sufficiently spiritual. We always use the words here, "whosoever will may come," not because you're worthy, nor because any church gives permission, but simply because Jesus offers himself to you, and you want to offer yourself in return. I hope tonight that we will hear the challenge of those words more clearly, because not only does it imply that nobody needs our permission to share at this table, but that sharing at this table constitutes who we are. Whosoever will may come, may be an insider, may be one of us, because us has no other meaning. There is no them who may not also be us, because there's no limit on the supply of love and mercy and acceptance that Jesus shares here. It probably is still too radical for us to get our heads around fully anytime soon. The first followers of Jesus kept getting it hellishly wrong too. But maybe it will only be by practicing it, starting here at this table where our risen Lord models it for us, that we will ever begin to get it.